Hi, this is Mike McNamara, and you're listening to All Marine Radio on your home for it, the one and only All Warrior Radio Network.
It is 6 minutes after nine here on the West Coast. Joining me from Kansas City, or a little bit outside Kansas City, if I'm not mistaken, Will Cosentini. Will, how you doing?
Great. Good morning.
I don't really.
My bumper music. Whoa.
Yeah, that's Santana. Are you a Santana guy?
Yeah, I like it. I'm just surprised. I thought you might have something a little darker.
No, what, in tribute to you? I thought about it, but I looked up, and I didn't see really other than some rap music shit that I could have played. When dark things are coming, I play a little Eminem, which might be more appropriate, but I tried to like fake it a little bit. So
there you go.
So welcome to the program. I know Will as Vito. That's his nickname that he was given low many years ago. So if you catch me slipping into one, that's who we're talking about. So Will, let's talk about you a little bit. Born and raised where?
I was born outside of Cleveland, but I grew up in upstate New York. Near Ithaca,
and your dad's a smart guy.
He is. Started his own engineering business. Grew up in New York City, graduated high school when he was 16. Went to City College. Was actually there at the time Colin Powell was here in the 50s, and started his own engineering business in the 70s, and retired when he was 78 years old. Company's still going strong, and. He's 84 now and still as smart as they come.
What kind of engineering did he do?
He was he's an electrical engineer, and his specialty, if you have a vibration sensor and a readout device, you need an electronic filter in the middle of it. And so that was his specialty. And if you think applications, they did a lot of work in the 80s with the Navy and silencing nuclear submarines. They're in wind tunnels. Now they put them in MRI machines. So pretty high-tech type of stuff.
Wow.
Yeah.
So there you go. That explains where the genius comes from. So how does the Naval Academy and military service get on your radar in upstate New York?
You know, it's one of the great questions of my life. I knew that that's what I wanted to do when I was about 15 or 16 years old.
Come on.
Yeah, really.
Were you that kid? Like how? How did you know that?
It's something, you know. When I retired, I said you got sort of three questions. Why'd you join? Why'd you stay? And why are you leaving? And the great mystery for me is why I joined. For some reason, it's just I knew that's what I wanted to do.
Really? So were you a history reader as a kid? Did you know the Navy? Explain the Navy. I mean, you had, you know, upstate New York. Come on, that's Army country.
Yeah, I mean, for some reason, I wanted to be a Marine officer. And at some point.
Why?
I don't know.
Again, come on. Were you like me?
No, no Marines in my family.
But
dad was a corpsman in the Navy Reserve.
Okay.
My mother's father, so my grandfather, retired as an Army colonel, World War II, Korea, Signal Corps veteran.
Okay.
But didn't have a lot of contact with him growing up. He was working for NASA at that time in tracking stations in South America that were tracking Gemini and Apollo programs. So didn't see a lot of them. And my mom was not some sort of gung-ho, you know, military supporter. I mean, I grew up in the time, figure the draft was still going on when I was a little kid. So I don't know.
So you don't know. You know, all of a sudden you wake up one day and say, I want to be a Marine officer. No, I didn't.
It's hard to pinpoint the time, but I was.
Well, you read something. You saw something. Okay.
Yeah.
Did you have a brain injury when you were a kid?
Yeah.
What kind of
that would be a nice sort of elegant solution to this problem?
Yes, because I am not buying it. I mean, I read all the books in my Scholastic Book Club, the little pamphlet that we used to bring home, and I read Guadalcanal Diaries. I read, you know, the Battle of the Bulge and every book I could read, and that's where I got brainwashed about Marines. And I read all that stuff. I watched the movies. I watched all that stuff. And then living, going down to Southern California is where I was really around Marines. They would come to the ball games on Sunday. The recruits would from MCRD. And you'd see them sitting up there, right, in their seats, right, hands on their knees the whole game with the DI standing in the aisles, you know, with their smokies on and their arms folded. And then across on the other side of the stadium, directly opposed to them, you'd see the recruits. This is back in the day when they had two naval training centers, one in San Diego and one at Great Lakes. And they would be up there having a party. And they'd be up going, getting hot dogs. And the contrast was, and I every Sunday I'd watch this shit. And I just watch the Marines and I go, man, those guys are tough guys. And so I, you know, then you'd see them around the community and whatnot, and they'd always look great in their uniforms. So I was like, if I join the military, I'm not joining the military, I'm joining the Marine Corps. So, I mean, that's my story, okay? You saying, yeah, I don't know why. I just like, and the Naval Academy at 15, those are like weirdo kids, okay?
Yeah. Yeah. Never claimed I wasn't.
You're not helping me here. You're giving me nothing.
Yeah, you know, and here's an interesting story. I didn't know this when I was growing up there. Remember Graves Hall, Terry Graves?
Yes, of course.
So
tell everybody what Graves Hall is.
It was one of the BOQ, Bachelor Officer Quarters, at the basic school. And I think when they rebuilt the basic school, they may have kept Graves Hall, but I'm not sure. So Graves was... second lieutenant, killed in action, Vietnam, force reconnaissance guy, Medal of Honor recipient. So our rival high school when I grew up was Groton. I went to Dryden. Groton was our rival. I didn't know this till after I was maybe back at the basic school on the staff. Graves had actually lived in Groton. His father was the superintendent of schools. And they didn't move there until he had gone to college. I think he went to Miami of Ohio. But he would be in Groton in the summers. He was a big baseball player at Miami of Ohio.
Right.
And would be in Groton and worked with the kids there in the summer leagues and all that stuff. So that was in the 70s. And in downtown Groton, which is like, I think there's a flashing red light. I don't think it's a stoplight. And there's a little general store thing. And maybe funeral parlor and a church, there's a memorial to Terry Graves, Medal of Honor recipient. And I never knew that when I was growing up. And this is, not 10 miles from where I lived. And I've been to Groton a bunch of times because that was one of the teams we always played in high school.
And so, but you did not know that?
Didn't know it at all. And now every time I go up to see my parents, which isn't all that often, I always drive out to Groton just to go see that memorial.
Let me just tell you just a little, some facts about Terrence Graves. Right? During his high school years, he was the senior patrol leader of the Boy Scouts of America, president of the Methodist Youth Fellowship. He was a battalion commander of his NROTC unit and a member of the Beta Theta Pi fraternity while attending the Miami University. So, I mean, Terrence Graves had leadership in him from the time he was a little guy. And in December of 1967, he was with 3rd Force Reconnaissance Company of the 3rd Marine Division and became a posthumous recipient of the Medal of Honor when a fight breaks out when they're on a patrol in Quang Tri Province. 16 February 1968. So anyway, yeah, Terrence Graves. Anyway, So that's as close as you could come to any reason why you
But that wasn't a reason. I didn't know any of that when I was a kid.
So you have no reason.
No.
You have no reason that you went to the Naval Academy. That's not like...
No, I do. The reason I went to the Naval Academy is because I knew you could get a Marine commission there. That's why I went.
So you, but you had no, you had, you didn't know anything about Marines. There's a piece of the story that's someplace in here, okay?
And
why
and
Marines?
Again,
why Marines?
I couldn't tell you.
But why don't you want to say it? You,
no, I wish
you
I
know
knew.
It. You know it. You just don't want to say it.
No,
what is
I
it?
Wish I knew.
What is
I,
it?
I honestly don't. Like I said, at my retirement.
Your sister.
I don't know why I joined.
Your sister teased you about being a sissy, and you were trying to prove that you weren't a sissy, so you thought the Marine Corps.
I wish I had something. I said, when I retired, I said, I don't know why I joined. I know why I stayed, because I want to be like these guys, right? And why do you leave? Because
this is ridiculous, Vito. This is ridiculous, okay?
Everybody, does it surprise you?
Everybody knows why they joined, okay? You know, you talk to Woody Williams. I'm growing up in West Virginia. We didn't see too many Marines. And this Marine comes walking into my town, and he's got those dress blues on. And I thought, man, if I could get a set of those, I could get a girl, right? And then he winds up carrying a flamethrower on Iwo Jima. Right.
That'll teach you.
Exactly. Right. And you get all kinds of stories like that. Guy walks into our cafeteria. Right. He's ripped in this good looking uniform. He's got a small waist. Who's that? What did they do? Oh, those are Marines. I want to be one of them. Everybody's got a story. And you got no story.
I got no story.
That's bullshit. That's bullshit. All right. The now that we've got, we know you have no story. So there's like, so how does the Marine Corps get on your radar? There's no answer to that.
There is none.
All right. So let's talk current events. All right. So, well, wait. Tell everybody about the rest of your career. You have an illustrious military career.
Well,
give us like a 90-second version of your career.
Sure. I was an infantry officer 3 years in 3-8 in Lima Company. Went back to the basic school on the staff.
3-8 Marines is being disbanded, yes?
You know, I haven't seen that. I'm not that close to it anymore.
I think. I hate to
they
break.
They would be. I hate. That's how it works. The numbers go down.
I hate to break the news to you, but yeah. 8th is gone. 5th is not, just for the record.
No, they'll
get around.
You know, they go down in reverse order.
They'll go down. They'll get 5th Marines one of these years.
Yeah. So I was there for 3 years, same rifle company in Lima Company, and at the basic school, 2 years in tactics, and I was a CO of the enlisted instructor company. Went to AWS, old school.
Who?
I was with the UN for a year on the Iraqi border after the Gulf War. Then I went to 2-6. And I was CEO of Echo Company for 2 years there. And the day I got promoted, I went to 1-2. And I was a 3 in the XO there. So my first half of my career, I was basically in my MOS or in school the whole time. And I paid for those sins. First, I went to be a foreign area officer. I went to Monterey, got a degree, went to Arabic language school, lived in Cairo for a year. Then I went to headquarters. Was in the Strategic Initiatives Group, which is sort of like the Commandant's mini think tank. I went to be the CEO of First LAR. Went to Iraq, came back. I went to school again. Then I went to the Joint Staff. Some very interesting things there in the Joint Staff. I worked for Air Force Lieutenant General Frazier, who was the assistant to the chairman, and the biggest thing we did is he was appointed by President Bush to be the monitor of the roadmap between the Palestinians and Israelis. So I spent a lot of time in Israel my last 9 months or so there. Then I was CO Weapons Training Battalion in Quantico, and then I finished up as the military assistant to the assistant commandant for General Amos as he was going out, General Dunford, and then General Paxton before I retired. Retired in 2013, coming up on 7 years.
Really? Damn. Yeah.
Yeah.
That's fast. I don't want it, not that that's shocking, but it doesn't seem like that long, and yet it is.
Yeah.
It is. All right, let's talk current events now, now that we know about your illustrious career. And what's important is that that last little nugget that he slid in there, you know, Will had a chance to, right, and at other times in his career, but he had a chance to, you know, see decision-making at high levels. Give me your take on your United States Navy.
The biggest thing on the radar now or within the last couple of weeks has been this whole thing with the Roosevelt.
Which is the latest in a string of what I think you would call a shit show.
Yeah. The Navy is out there every day, and is supposed to be a deterrent, right? Sea lanes open, but adversaries know that the Navy's out there. And when you see the things that make the press, so you see Navy transits South China Sea. So that's 5% of what the Navy is seen for. But the rest of it, you see sort of convoluted decision-making, questionable decisions, collisions, investigations. The recent thing with the CEO of the Roosevelt, and who knows what the real story is, but seemingly putting information out in the public domain in a way that not necessarily is contributing to the mission and to deterrence. It's challenging, right? Because
What does challenging exactly mean in that context?
Yeah, it gives you pause. It does not generate confidence.
Yeah, okay.
That the Navy is a service that's focused on what it's supposed to be doing to defend the nation. The CEO of an aircraft carrier, strategic asset. And one of the things he says is we're not at war. Okay. Right. You do things in war where you're typically willing to take a little bit more calculated risk based on what the requirements and the mission are.
Give us an example of that. Like, give me a wartime example of that that might have to do with maintenance.
So as a CEO of First LAR, and I was no LAV expert, to say the least, you know, there's a lot of criteria there that come down from on high, the program manager, LAV. You're shepherding a significant capital asset for the Marine Corps. And so you have maintenance requirements that, as the CEO, I'm not going to violate those requirements, right? I'm doing something for the Commandant here to make sure that this asset is available and that it's ready. And that it's going to be available and ready far into the future. In a combat environment, you've got to put forces forward. And so when a maintenance officer comes and tells you that he needs to do a 48-hour stand down in the middle of your 7-month deployment to ensure that you check all your maintenance blocks, I gave him 4 hours because I need to push combat power forward. And I'm willing to take the risk that potentially long-term maintenance is degraded of that capital asset. But the reason I have a capital asset is to use it in the fight now. And that my mission now requires me to have presence, and I'm unwilling to take the risk of not having that presence. And I am willing to take the risk of degraded maintenance. And if the program manager for LAV has got a real problem with that, then he can come out there to the Syrian border and explain it to me, right? That's how you can calculate different things. The Roosevelt situation, not entirely analogous, but you want to take a strategic deterrent capital asset offline. I think that takes direct personal conversations with the chain of command, and the CO of the ship, that's not your call at that time. That's someone else's call that's calculating what's the risk to crew, what's the risk to mission, what's the risk to anything else. You don't get to make that kind of decision. So that's where I sort of approached when I heard about this. And take that and then just take the sort of fumbling through this that we went through, the acting secretary of the Navy, and then he resigns. And now we have a preliminary inquiry that's done seemingly at the service chief level, even though the secretary is the one that relieved the guy. And now we've got the chairman with his joint hat on and the sec def seemingly at odds with the service chief. I mean, you know, you write a novel with this in it, and they don't even give you a second look, right? They throw it in the trash pile.
Yeah, this is too crazy. Could you bring it, dial it down a little bit closer to reality? Like this could ever happen.
Yeah. But here we are.
But here we are.
And it's become frighteningly political because that's where we are with the current administration. You can predict what everyone on either side of the divide is going to say based on how it impacts, you know, people's view of the president. And, you know, that's not giving confidence.
Then you have the whole public relations nightmare of that fucking video of the sailors like chanting, right? And that's heartbreaking, right? Which adds to the carnival environment of this thing.
Yeah.
Which brings us to Admiral Gilday's looking at the preliminary inquiry that was done, and he's got to make a decision. I want to kind of go down that rabbit hole with you. Now there's a number of, you be Admiral Gilday and I'll be General Milley, right? So you're considering that, and the preliminary inquiry, what are the things that you are going to put the most emphasis on as you look at the actions of Captain Crozier as this thing comes to you?
Yeah. So first I want to back it out just a second. The acting secretary is the one who took the decision to relieve Crozier. So why does the service chief handle the investigation? That I don't know.
Well, he directs it because
why wouldn't the new secretary direct that?
Well, I think when it came right down to it, that's ultimately what happened.
Okay. So then
I think Esper and Milley just expressed, I think it started from what I've read, it started with Milley recommending to the Secretary of Defense that he'd like to see, before this thing gets fully adjudicated, a full investigation. And then Esper concurred with that, and then the acting SecNav directed that.
Yeah, so if you're the CNO and you get this thing, you know, what's important? First, what are the true facts? What was the number of people that had the virus, what were things that the CEO of the ship had within his control to attempt to mitigate it? How did he communicate those things? What ideas did he have requiring extra resources? So that's part of it. Then the second part of it is, how did he handle it after that? How did he communicate those requirements? What answers did he get? How did he engage in the conversation with his superiors to ensure that the facts as he understood them were laid out, and what was his recommendation? And so there's two different pieces of this thing. And I think where I get crosswise with the guy is the second part, the communication of it. And so if you're the CNO, You're looking at, okay, what's the right thing to do down there, individual level, and what's the right thing to do service level? You have to balance the entire portfolio. If the right thing is that he took all the right steps, he did all the communication required, et cetera, then, well, we wouldn't even be talking about this. But obviously something didn't go right here. And so how do we know what Admiral Gilday has recommended? It got leaked.
Only reports in the media.
If you're Admiral Gilday, how can you let that get leaked? People say, "Oh, things get leaked all the time." No, bullshit. I mean,
since you're being Admiral Gilday, what is, as you go through this in preliminary inquiry, what is the number one? What do you see as your number one job?
What's the mission of the Navy? That's my number one job. That's my number one job. And so how does the Navy come out of this at the back end to ensure we're the most capable, we're the most ready force now and going forward? That's what my job is.
See, if I switch hats and I become Gilday, I say, look, I've got to stop the bleeding here. Okay.
Yeah. We're saying the same thing. You said it one level down from me. Absolutely agree. Yeah. We got to stop this and get focused on what are we supposed to be doing here. And talking about this is not helpful to the mission of the United States Navy.
Now, you and I were talking yesterday. So if you're Mike Gilday, who was in your Naval Academy class, yeah?
He was. I didn't know him there, but he was.
Okay. All right. So we won't hold you personally responsible for his action, although we kind of will. He's in Vito's class, so whatever. So when this thing looks, because of its visibility, when this thing looks like you're going to recommend – the reinstatement of Captain Crozier, do you pick up the phone and do you call me as chairman and say, "Hey, Mac, you got a minute? Can I come down and talk to you? Because I think you and I should sit down and talk about this." Do you?
Yeah, I think that's the only thing you can do. It's that, or it's a four-way conversation. SecNav, chairman, SecDef, because you're going in two directions here. One up through the SecNav to the SecDef, the other chairman to the SecDef. But at some point,
and so we're all on the same sheet of music. We're not going to do shit show, another round of the shit show. There's been too much shit show going on relative to this already.
Yeah. And then you determine if you're the CNO. And this is the biggest deal ever. And, you know, you're going to go to the mat. You at least got to tell your bosses you're going to the mat on it. But it's hard for me to imagine that this is what I want to go to the mat as a CNO. But then again, how does this thing get leaked?
Right.
I don't want to disparage Admiral Gilday's integrity or anything like that. But one of the things you've got to do is ensure this thing doesn't get leaked, period. You owe that to your bosses. So there's a failure right there.
It looks like a couple, though. Because judging from the reaction of Millie and Esper, this thing doesn't come out as a team event that's designed to, you know, reduce turbulence and have the Navy take a solid step. This looks like more dysfunction, we're not on the same sheet of music, and oh yeah, guess what? We're not doing that, because even if Crozier should be reinstated, I can't reinstate him because of the perception is that when you're unhappy, you can voice this publicly and you can still keep your job. I cannot have that. As a SecDef and the chairman.
Not a perception, that becomes a reality.
Right.
And no, you can't have that.
So I would, if you were to categorize this, I mean, and so how does the leak get there? So now you got the leak, you got different sheets of music. This is under the big canopy of shit show, yes?
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah.
Absolutely.
Yeah. All right. How do you think it will turn out after at the end of this? Do you think that the full blown investigation is? I use the word soft relief in the first hour. It's like, okay, we're going to off ramp this. We're going to bring the old CO back. He'll do another year, and by the time we get this this full investigation done, you know, we will, you know, we'll say, yeah, that ain't happening. How do you believe it will turn out? Look into your crystal ball.
Yeah, it's difficult for me to imagine that. Well, now I think the SecDef is involved. It's difficult for me to imagine that the SecDef, or whoever the SecNav is going to be, is going to say, "Oh, we should do some sort of reinstatement." First of all, how the hell do you do that? Right.
How do you thread that? Even if you wanted
expression, order, counterorder, disorder. So we're at counterorder phase right now. You can go to disorder by, you know, so, and Crozier was relieved. Okay. So he's, I think I saw he was class of 90 maybe. So he's 28 years. He's going to go somewhere in the secretariat, I'm sure. And do 2 years, and he's going to retire. And, oh, woe is me. He didn't get to be an airborne. Well, fuck him. You know, 96% of people don't get to be admirals. I'm over it. He'll be fine. There's been a lot of people in history that have suffered much worse. But in the end, are you there for the institution or not? And at that point in your life, that's what you're supposed to be doing. So...
Yeah, all right.
I can't imagine a reinstatement. Although, this is the United States Navy in the second decade of the 21st century.
Yeah, and this one's under the big top of the shit show. So,
you know.
Again, that's what. But again, the more I thought about this over the weekend, and the more I thought about the way things work at that level, and I didn't get to see the decision making that Will did, but when I was working for General Mattis, I got to see a little bit of it, and you know, whenever these things would happen, you would have, whether it be at the time Colonel Toulon or Colonel Tucker or any of the other, you know, regimental commanders. I mean, and the world was watching the events of that went on in Fallujah, Ramadi, out in the west where Will was. It was the eyes of the world were on the Al Anbar province in Baghdad. And so, you know, when things that were going to be visible, I mean, there was huddles and conferences about how we were going to handle this, right? So to make sure we're doing it right, and then to make sure we communicate it right, to make sure we're all on the same sheet of music. So, I mean, you get a chance to see a little bit of it, and this doesn't have any or very much of that.
Yeah, and look, people define things as loyalty. Loyalty is not doing what your boss wants. Loyalty is giving your boss the opportunity to help solve the problem, right? If there's a problem that's somewhere between your level and his, or at his level, you owe him the information, whether he's going to like it or not, to give him an opportunity to be involved. And it's not so everything's smooth over and everyone's happy, but that's what the boss, that's one of the things that he does, allocates resources and helps solve problems. And you present your boss a fait accompli in public that is above really what your pay grade is, then that's disloyal. Loyal is not turning your problem over to him, but letting them know you got a problem and here's the COAs that you're thinking about, and here's the risk or the downside to those things. That's loyalty at that level.
You know,
you should expect that of your subordinates.
We both work for Joseph Dunford, and I worked for him. He was the chief of staff, and I remember vividly him saying specifically what you just said, Mac. I can control a couple things. I control resources, and I can surge effort. Okay, I can't do anything if you won't tell me the problem.
There you go.
And he said, so the hardest thing that we do, and this is after he had been the chief of staff, General Kelly left, and he stepped up, and he was the assistant division commander. And he said, you know, the biggest thing, you know, as I'm learning as a general, and I watch it as a colonel and the chief of staff is, you know, people are afraid to tell, whether it be General Mattis or General Natonsky or me or General Kelly, they're afraid to tell us the ugly truth.
Yeah.
But we can't help. You know, we can't help if we don't know.
And, yeah. I told people when I worked in the ACMAC's office, you know, my job, our job is not to make the Commandant happy. There's 185,000 Marines who want to see the Commandant smile. Our job is to help him make good decisions. And for that, he needs information, typically information that other people don't want to give him.
Right.
So, and it can be freaking painful. Well, you're the guy in the room that's a little contrary. But, well, I enjoyed it. That being said.
It didn't seem to bother you very much. It did seem to bother you. No, I mean, but, you know, and this is what was interesting about, you know, and I told everybody when you were coming on. If you listen to my friends, right, you listen to Jeff Kenny and Tim Lynch, you listen to Will, Dave Furness, Paul Kennedy has come on. We were all lieutenant captains at the basic school. And intellectually, we were kind of built the same way. We were not afraid, right, to get it on in public and let it rip on each other. And we didn't take it personally, right, very often. And we've all been, you know, more or less friends since, you know, 1990, as we intellectually cross paths. And there is this blunt, you know, not afraid of the truth streak in all these relationships, which to me make it interesting, and why most of these guys were very, very successful in what they did, because you could always count on them for that. But no, it's a strain that I enjoy. I enjoy it. Everybody, I want to switch gears, talk about the COVID thing. You have some pretty strong opinions on the nation surrendering many of its freedoms without a whole lot of discussion.
Yeah. And this, you know, for some reason I've had sort of a string of my reading in the last couple of years, and recently in particular, the idea of experts versus generalists and what's called sort of kind versus wicked problems. And there's a lot of research that shows experts are valuable in certain circumstances, but experts tend to frame problems within their realm of expertise. And so what is the problem with COVID? Well, if you frame it as people are going to get sick and die in the U.S., then the experts will tell you how to solve it. The problem is that's not the problem. That's not the only facet of the problem. And so we went to a pretty draconian way to address it based on what the experts told us. And so we got 30 million people out of work and counting. We've got people not getting routine health assessments, which discover unknown problems. You've got the use of cancer drugs going down. Why is that? It ain't that people don't have cancer, it's that people are not going to the doctor and finding things. And so there's a lot of carnage on the side of this problem that very well could overtake the carnage of the problem we're trying to address. So that's level one. And then level two, the idea that some unelected public health official operating on someone's interpretation of a law that puts an emergency order in effect that basically takes away your constitutional rights, it can be done, right? Lincoln did it, suspended habeas corpus during the war. But you can't go to church? That's, to me, insanity that people are willing to do that. And
it was done without a question, too.
Yeah, absolutely. And then the other thing which I've discovered in my life is...
But hold on. You can go to Home Depot and you can social distance and you can go to Home Depot. I can go get food and I can wait in line with a group of people at Chipotle.
I can go to a liquor store.
And I can go to liquor. And so those are all okay to go to because somehow or other I'm going to social distance there, but I can't do the same thing at a paint store. I can't do the same thing at a church because that's not necessary.
Yeah, and first of all, let's be precise. Social distancing is what we don't want to do. We want to do physical distancing. Social distancing isolates people.
Better term.
Somehow the term has become social distancing. It's gobbledygook, right? We need to physically distance from each other. And as I said, the thing that I've discovered is I don't know how to push back on this. Right? I queried the Kansas Department of Health about what were the specific things that necessitated a stay-at-home order. And the email response was, well, we need to flatten the curve. Well, in Kansas, there's like 100 counties. 20-something of them have zero cases. 20-something of them have five cases or less. So by definition, there is no curve in Kansas. But we had an order that went across the board. And so I said, well, what does flatten the curve mean? And the response was, we're all trying to figure that out now. So I wrote a letter to the governor because the governor doesn't have a web an email address available on her website. And I just said, I'm interested in what were the specifics that you saw that required the statewide, one-size-fits-all, stay-at-home order. When will we know that we have achieved our desirements for that stay-at-home order and how will we lift the stay-at-home order? And so I wrote a letter to the governor, and in 3 weeks I haven't had any kind of response. So how does a citizen push back against these things? Well, you do it in elections, but that's sort of blunt force, and it's not in real time. And that's not good, right? That's not good that you have no say in any of this.
It's interesting because this whole thing in California, you can't go to the beach and you talk to law enforcement people and and the governor overreacts, closes the beaches in Orange County based on a photograph taken from a pier with a telephoto lens on a horizontal plane, all right, which is not the view you want going to look at social distancing on the beach. You want it shot from the parking lot to the water. That's how you're going to see the social distancing. And so if you talk to the law enforcement people, the lifeguards and the firefighters, they said, no, 90% of people, were social distancing. There was families that were together, which we would expect, and there was space between everybody. It wasn't an issue. And then you have the governor. And so it's interesting. You have the governor then turn around and close all the beaches, right?
Yeah,
and,
because you have offended him.
Right.
Now.
Right.
It's
and
not,
now, and now
anything
he's
saying rational.
Right. And now he's stuck in that spot. Right. And he's not going to come out of there quickly. And he's applied one set of rules through the whole state. And so now you're looking as a citizen, you're looking at going.
Kansas. I don't know, a couple, 3 million people, 136 deaths. 20% of the cases are age 55 and older, 89% of the deaths. The median age, 82 years old. The youngest person to die in Kansas, 42 years old. 50-something people out of the 136 in Kansas that have died have been 85 years old or older. If we would have taken 10% of the effort and applied it to nursing homes, we would have saved half of those people or more, and the rest of us could have gone on. But now, 30 million people and counting unemployed. And there's really very good statistics that correlate unemployment with negative health outcomes. Suicide, cancer, heart. Well, how do people get cancer when they're unemployed? I don't know. But there's very good statistical correlation. 2007 through 2009, 2000, recession in like 94 or something, 93, 94, 91, 92, whatever, at the end of the Bush years. Very good correlations between unemployment goes up and so does poor public health outcomes.
Right.
Go. And so we are going to kill people, second and third order effect of doing this, as well as take away constitutional rights, et cetera. So my congresswoman had a phone-in show yesterday, and I listened to the transcript this morning. And, you know, she's a relatively hard-left Democrat from Kansas City. That's fine. And she had the public health officer from Wyandotte County. So there's two counties that surround Kansas City on the Kansas side, Johnson County, where I live, Wyandotte County. And they're both have the most cases. So this guy, whatever, he's a family doctor. He's been this public health guy. Neither of these guys is a proto-fascist, right? You don't get the sense that overtly as they talk, they want to run your life. But I'll tell you something. Their language and how they view the world, the congresswoman, the only thing that she sees about this is how are we going to spend more federal money on that? Well, federal money is state money, is local money, is my money. And there is not an inexhaustible supply of that. And the county health guy never once talked about what he was doing for the 16 years to be ready to prevent this. It's all about addressing things for the long term. And you know, if it's up to these people, we're going to have a ventilator in every home and a mask in every pot, and we're going to be broke because no one's going to be working. No one's going to pay taxes. We're going to spend the entire budget for the entire government on making sure that we don't get COVID when it's killed 136 people in Kansas. You know, 89% of those people are 75 years and older. I think if you threw out 15 nursing homes in the state, there's probably 10 people have died from it. It's insanity.
Let me read you an email. Mac, interesting discussion so far relative to the footnotes on these bigger issues that we face. I'd be curious to know what you and Vito think are the reasons why we don't question this. Is it an atypical response to a pandemic that created an overwhelming desire in the population to follow orders? Because Americans typically don't do that very well. Why did we go to the walk of the lemmings so quickly?
And again, first, how do you push back as an individual citizen? It's hard for me to find places to push back on this. I don't know if there's something in the culture now. I read a quote, the key to happiness is freedom, and the key to freedom is courage. You know where the quote's from? It's Thucydides. Over 2,000 years old. The key to happiness is freedom. The key to freedom is courage. There's nothing in there about safety. We have to be safe. Everyone needs to be safe. Courage, freedom. And, you know, I used to be the safety Nazi as a battalion commander. There's a time and a place for everything. But the idea that we all have to be safe from this virus, you know, so he who sacrifices freedom for safety and security will soon have neither. Here we are.
I don't know what saves it for us, because, you know, as we have 52 different solutions, if you count Guam and Puerto Rico, 52 governors will bring their government, their states out of whatever version of quarantine, and the numbers are going to rise. I mean, we don't even have, honestly, in my opinion, we haven't had the education for citizens to say, okay, look, the numbers are going to go up. So don't focus on the case numbers. Focus on, right, the at-risk population, the number of people that go into the ICU, and the number of people that die, and where those deaths come from. That's what you have to focus on.
Yeah, look at what the experts said. Experts said we need to flatten the curve so we don't overwhelm the healthcare system, because we don't want the healthcare system to break. Well, they have broken the healthcare system because hospitals are going out of business because they don't have any patients. And the hospitals are not overwhelmed. My parents live in upstate New York, Tompkins County. Two people have died in Tompkins County from this. Those two people were sent to Tompkins County from New York City. And the doctors and nurses from that county hospital were sent down to New York City. That hospital is going broke.
Yeah, you could fire a railgun through the hospital, as you can most in the country.
And those hospitals are going to go broke. So in the end, in order to save the healthcare system, we're going to destroy it. Because rural communities are not going to have hospitals. Right?
Right.
You're a county somewhere. I mean, you were there. Rural America, that hospital is it's the only one for 50 or 80 or 100 miles.
Right. Well, yeah. Absolutely. And
if it's a public hospital, how much of the budget? Because the budget can't expand like the federal government. Well, if we do that, then we're not going to have police. We're not going to have fire. We're not going to fix the roads. We're not going to repair the roof on the school. And if it's a private hospital, in the end, you got to make money. Or you go bankrupt.
And the profit margin in those things is not very big.
Yeah. Hey, think of rural churches. You can't pass the plate because no one's there. And when you can pass the plate, people are unemployed. And what bank is going to loan a church money, right? It's not a good investment.
Right.
So we're destroying things in order to save them.
No, and
I can remember something in Vietnam about how that was put out and people ridiculed it. But here we go again.
I saw an article that says the mortgage industry is going to need to be bailed out because people have stopped paying their rent. And it's like, you want my keys? Come take them, right?
But keep your social distance.
Yeah, keep your social distancing. In the last year, you lost your wife, Carrie, very suddenly, and also lost a job.
Yeah.
The whole reason for All Marine Radio was the down low proposition that if we talk about mental health, we can help people understand that what they're going through, they're not going through alone. And then what's come out of it, was not ever intended. But this whole idea of post-traumatic winning, this whole idea that not only can you live a good life, you can live a great life after trauma. You've been, however you rack and stack traumatic events in your life, at the top is the loss of a spouse, and not too far down the list is the loss of a job. How goes it? And do you have any advice for people, you know, on how do you navigate it? How did you navigate it?
Yeah, you know, my wife basically got sick on a Thursday, had surgery on Monday. She had colon cancer, and a tumor had perforated her bowel, and she had a massive infection. So she had surgery on Monday night, and she never woke up from that. She died on a Saturday. So Thursday to Saturday is when I knew. And she hadn't been well, but she hadn't been sick. She just had some days where she wasn't feeling well. And as I went through, you know, I replay events in my life, I realized that she had had this cancer for a long time, obviously. And so Thursday she got sick, Monday went to the hospital, Monday night she had surgery. And I talked to the doctor after she came out of surgery. I said, you know, how is she? And he said, well, it's 50-50. She's going to make it to tomorrow. So I basically had 5 days to process that she probably wasn't going to make it. And, you know, I'd only been in Kansas for a year and a half at that time, and I didn't have any, you know, deep personal relationship here. I had colleagues at work. I knew some people around here or there. And I didn't have any family that lived here either. My kids all lived somewhere else. So they came in. And it was really hard. That week, what actually made it a little bit easier is that between my mother-in-law and my kids and my parents, I had to hold things up. And so that was my mission for that week and the next week until we did a memorial service for her. And then when I went back to work, you know, a lot of good people, first, a lot of people came to that memorial service that were deep friends of mine, friends, you know, 30 years, guys that I knew when I was a lieutenant and throughout our time in the Marine Corps. And then my wife had a huge following in the sort of veteran support world out there. People that she had helped out that she actually never met in person. She knew him on Facebook. A lot of outpouring from those people. And those things are all good. And I would say the first thing is, if you know someone that has suffered some trauma, a simple thing to let them know you think about them and care, it actually means a lot to people. It meant a lot to me. And then when I went back to work, people sort of took it upon themselves to try and get closer to me to help, you know, just sort of mitigate the fact that I'm here alone. But I'll tell you, the first several months were really hard for me. Because I didn't, if you would have asked me, you know, 2 weeks before my wife had passed away, you know, what's your purpose in life? I don't really know. And I figured out after she died, one of my biggest purposes in life was just to take care of us and take care of her. And then all of a sudden I didn't have that. And so I wandered around quite a bit. And I thought pretty deeply about, you know, what are you going to do? I'm not sure I ever really resolved that. But also, what don't you want to do? What don't you want to become? And how are you going to know if you're getting there? And, you know, I don't drink in my house by myself. And I'm not a big drinker, but I said, I'm just not going to start doing that. I try and stay reasonably fit because that was my routine. And I think it's good for your mental health. But, you know, you never really get over it. It's every day for me. I still think about her, obviously. It's been over a year now. And eventually you develop other relationships. But it's hard. I mean, it's really hard. I don't have a real secret for that one because I mean, I'm not sort of at the end of the journey. I'm still in the middle of it.
What do you think? What do you then? Let me ask you some specific questions. What do you think are the things that helped you? You mentioned physical fitness. I know one of the things we talk about in you know, just the things that I hear over and over from veterans is, you know, financial turbulence, you know, accelerated my downward spiral. Alcohol accelerated. Alcohol actually is almost a gateway to this, a deeper form of hell. So
in talk terms about of, the finance for just a second. I don't think we were ever really extravagant spenders, and the debt that I had was basically in a mortgage on a house, and I was able to pay that off last December, and then I lost my job in January, and I don't know if it's a smart financial decision to pay off your mortgage when you're getting only paying 3.5% interest, but I got to tell you something. When I lost my job, and so now my income is my Marine Corps retired pay, but the fact that I didn't have any debt really came home to me at that time, how valuable that was. And now, you know, nobody's hiring now. I'm not going to find a job until who knows when. But the idea that you're not encumbered by debt is unbelievable. It gives you resilience that you didn't even know until it gets tested. And now that sort of financial resilience of mine has been tested by losing a job and then having this downturn. And it's one of the things that I don't have to worry about. And I would tell anybody out there, don't try and get rich quick. You can only really get rich slowly if you're people like us. And be conservative. And as soon as you can, particularly people of our age, you know, in your 50s, get yourself debt free. Pay, you know, meet your obligations, put the roof over your head, get your kids into college, you know, meet your obligations, but get out of debt as soon as you possibly can, because the black swan comes. If you would have told me January 29th, I was going to be unemployed on January 30th, I thought you're out of your mind, but it happened. And then if you would have told me on March 1st that unemployment is going to go from 3.5% to whatever it is, 15 or 20% in the next month, I would have thought you're out of mind again. And boom, it happened again. But that financial thing takes a huge, significant stressor out of you.
You know, I've said a couple points relative to things you just said. One is we are learning, or a lot of people are learning for the first time, why our grandparents used to say things like, pay as you go, you won't owe, right? Pay your bills off, right? I pay cash for my cars, right? You know, they'd ask you questions like, hey, are you saving your money? How'd you pay for this thing? Are you going to pay it off? And you know, you roll your eyes like, nah, grandma, you know, I'm leasing it, and then I'm gonna flip that into another. I'll be paying for it for 6 or 7 years, and they'd look at you, like, when do you have money? We poo-pooed that stuff. Their experience in the Depression, in the dust, through the Dust Bowl, all the things that their parents went through, and they didn't go through it for a period of months. It was a decade of that stuff, right? You know, and so we're, for the first time, you know, many people are learning why you have a savings account, right? And you know, the statistics, 52% of Americans live paycheck to paycheck. 70% of Americans can't afford to miss a paycheck. And now they've missed, what, 4, going on 5? And so you're, all this wisdom that we blew off, I've got a credit cards, I've got this, is, you know, it's, fuck, to be able to tell somebody to fuck off is to have a savings account. Okay, that's fuck off money. And so, and then the other part of what you're talking about is I've had my own financial problems in my life, and I would say I say this, and Will will understand it. I would rather be shot at any day of the week than lay in bed as a provider and stare at the ceiling and wonder, how am I going to do it this month?
Absolutely.
I don't know how I did it last month, for God's sakes. How am I going to pull a rabbit out of a hat financially again this month? And one of the reasons you see farmers with such a high suicide rate is that now all of a sudden I've had, crops go bad on me for 4 years, right? I had this bad investment, I've had this drought and whatnot. And now a farm that's been in my family for 4 or 5 generations, I'm going to lose it. And they lay in bed at night and ultimately, check out the rate of suicide among farmers, because it's a special kind of hell. If you get killed in combat, your family gets $500,000. Your wife will find somebody else. Life will go on. If you fail them, that is a special form of, I don't even know what to call it, but it's a special form of hell that I would tell you, I'd clearly rather be shot at any day of the week.
Absolutely. And it's interesting where I am now in life is, my kids are all well established and still employed and doing well. I don't have any grandkids. I don't have to take care of my wife, and lost my job and figured out, I like to work. I got a lot out of sort of being part of groups and seeing people learn and do something they didn't think they could do. And I get a lot of mental sort of spiritual satisfaction out of that. And I miss that. What is your purpose? And giving back, people say you want to give back and be part of something. It isn't always just, volunteering or doing this or doing that, but it's actually just being part of the machine and making the machine run better. And so I don't know where I'm going to end up, but I know I like to be engaged in those kinds of things because, you got a PhD in leadership after a career as a Marine officer, and teaching people that and seeing people perform and seeing teams come together, it's good for them. And that's what I think that I want to be part of in doing. But I mean, I recognize I've been sitting at home for 3 months now. I gotta find that sort of thing. And I'm not sure that I knew that even 4 months ago. Like I said, I didn't know what I was doing. I lost my wife, and I realized one of my big purposes in life was to just take care of us and take care of her. And I didn't have that. And then I was, in a lot of ways, I was going through the motions. And in that time, I had a lot of bad days. I sort of knew where my red lines were. I never really got close to them. But I just had a lot of bad days because I didn't know what I was doing. Didn't know what I was supposed to be doing. And it's taken, unfortunately, second sort of this event was very unexpected, but it hasn't been traumatic to me.
When you say this COVID thing,
losing my job and then rolling into this thing.
Well, let me read you an email. Mac, first of all, pretty interesting little twist here. Wasn't really expecting this from this interview. I have a question. After losing his wife and going through that, when he lost his job, what went through his head? A lot of people would be buckled by that. Your guest, Vito, doesn't seem to be that way. Why? So, and again, I won't go into the particulars, but I mean, you can imagine the outpouring of the number of people that reached out from your place of business when you lose a spouse. And then all of a sudden, one of those people calls you up and says, yeah, we're done with you.
Right. Yeah. You know, I'll tell you something. So when I worked for General Dunford in particular, it was hot and heavy in Afghanistan. And, you know, Bethesda was filled up. And the only people who gave out Purple Hearts in Washington, D.C. was the commandant and the assistant commandant. And so we would go every other week to Bethesda and spend at least a half a day there giving out Purple Hearts to guys. Missing legs, missing arms, missing two legs, being there sometimes with their family, often their parents, sometimes their wives. And pretty emotional, you know. But of all those guys, not one of them gave the woe is me, why did this happen to me? And when I thought about it, I figured out most of them were very future focused, because we would go in, general would talk to them, we'd talk to the parents, the aide would come in, he'd award the Purple Heart, he'd take some pictures, and we'd send those pictures back to the unit, let them know their guy was there and how he was doing. And I used to hang around in the rooms a little bit after that and talk to them. And they were all like, hey, sir, when am I going to be able to get a wheelchair? How long does it take to get a fake leg put on? Where do I get to go after this? Very future focused people. And I said, if a guy that's 21 years old that just had both legs taken off above the knee can be worried about the future and not about the past, that's a pretty good life lesson.
Right.
And I have tried, and it's not part of the human psyche necessarily to not think about the past and how the world's against me and et cetera. But I really tried to adopt that philosophy because, you know, you don't have a time machine and you can't go back. You can't go back and do it differently. You want to learn from things, but I don't want to be encumbered by that sort of emotion. And so I think that experience, dealing with those wounded Marines helped me do that. I think, you know, things throughout my life helped me do that. It was something that helped me, get through when my wife was really sick and I knew she wasn't going to make it. And you know, there's been moments I've been pretty unhappy with some of the people I used to work for. Although, to be very fair, they treated me exceptionally well last year, and they treated me well when they let me go, you know. But still, it's like, you know, what did I do wrong? Why did these people do this to me? And I said, you know what? What are the lessons? Get over the emotion and move forward. Because if you don't, you're going to dwell in that forever. And that's what you'll have defined yourself that way instead of trying to define yourself on tomorrow and the next day. And, you know, before you break out in peals of laughter that I've suddenly become, you know, rainbows and unicorns and all like that, I still take, you know, the world is typically, the glass isn't half empty or half full. It's usually broken with some dirty water in the bottom. That's how I view it. But I figured out I don't want to be, you know, balled up in the corner, sucking my thumb, wondering why everybody hates me and the world isn't fair. Right. So be future focused. I saw it in guys that I didn't know that had the worst deal ever, seemingly. And they were focused on, what do I get to do next? So I thought that was a great lesson. It helped me, without a doubt.
Here's another email. Mac, it's interesting, the financial comments that have been made by your guest. Does he think that his reaction would have been much different had he been saddled with debt when he lost his job?
Yeah, absolutely. And right now I'd be scrambling because I've been out of work for 3 months and, you know, the job market for 56-year-old whatever's in the middle of Kansas City may or may not be good at any given time, but it's zero right now. And it's probably zero for another, 3 months? If we do a phased opening, that takes us to the middle of June. Businesses are going to assess where they're at, what the future is. Well, that takes a month or 6 weeks. And so I don't think there's any real prospect to finding anything until August. Well, shit, I've been out of work for 7 months at that time. And everyone tells you in the best case scenario, you know, you have 6 months of savings. Boom, that's gone. I'm in a much, much different, much more resilient situation because I don't owe anybody a nickel. And I do have an income stream, right? I mean, well, you know, Marine Corps pension is pretty good.
Right. The other thing you point out, it's really good when your house is paid off, right?
Yeah. Yeah.
The other thing, though, that you point out is the plight that a lot of people are going to undergo. Anybody that was connected to the hospitality industry as
done.
They are now contemplating, right, we're not going to make our mortgage payment starting June 1st, right? We paid it out of hide, you know, and now our savings, we've gone through our savings, and now what little savings we have left, we have to shepherd that, you know, in case the kids get sick, the car goes out, you know, and then what little money we have will be in unemployment between, you know, the two of us. We'll pay our current, you know, our cell bill, our car insurance, gas, and food, and that's all we have. And that is no small amount of the population right now is contemplating that.
And look, there's a lot of people that are out of work that weren't full-time employees.
Right.
You know, there's an intact family, and maybe neither of them was a full-time employee and may not even qualify for unemployment in certain circumstances. There is tremendous single mom who can't work from home, who still has to go into work, has got two kids who've been home from school for the last 6 weeks. How's that going?
Oh, yeah.
You dump them on grandma or someone else, or
to go,
how many kids
to go where? Just, to go yeah, where? Many, do what?
How many kids have just been left unsupervised at home? Because mom has got to go to work because not everyone can work from home. Yeah, those things, again, that's where the leader should be taking a portfolio approach to this. And not necessarily diving in with the expert that this is all about COVID. It's not all about COVID. It's all about balancing that risk across the entire portfolio.
But I don't hear that. I don't hear that discussion. And anybody who goes near it, and you know, color the governors of Georgia, Oklahoma, and Texas, as that they get absolutely drugged through the mud, you know, nationally. By media people that say, oh, you're choosing to go to work and killing people.
Yeah, you're writing the death certificates for 20,000 people. Right. Yeah, well, stop it.
Well, and then what's interesting, though, is if you look at Sweden's approach, which was we're trying to balance, you know, we're trying to balance several things, but we're trying not to overload our medical system, which is centrally operated. And so we've kept our we understand viruses. We've kept our restaurants open. We've kept our schools going. And although our death rate is higher than Norway and Denmark, who both hit the pause button on everything, when they hit the play button, their numbers are going to go up.
Hell right? Yeah.
Our numbers.
And all of the second and third order effects
right,
are
right.
going up in Norway and Denmark as we speak.
Right. And he went on to say, we think people will slowly come to the Swedish model because what we tried to implement a program that we could sustain. And that to me, exactly. And if you read, there's I put the links up in hour one yesterday. So anybody listening out there, you can go and you can read the USA Today interview with this guy. He's the head of epidemiology in Sweden. And very interesting about it. But that term right there, we tried to do something that we can sustain. And so what's going to happen here in the United States is now we're going to unpause this son of a bitch. And guess what? All the numbers are going to go up, right? But what numbers do we focus on? Because when you see a headline, Georgia comes out of this, you know, coronavirus positive test quadruple. Well, as long as they quadruple in the portion of the population that can take the virus, that's okay. And that promotes what's called herd immunity. And that's what Sweden is going to benefit from. What we have to do is protect the most vulnerable. But we're not having that mature conversation about this. No. We're responding to the headline and the death. And in the meantime, you know, we have not focused on our elderly. We have not focused on our elderly in rural areas. And now we continue to see these horrific stories that a healthcare worker brought it from home. Right. Their child got it, you know, from someplace, brought it into the senior living center. And then, you know, all these people died. Right. Nobody knows it. Right. We didn't focus on it. And Sweden, much to their credit, said we failed in that area, too. And we have to fix this. We have to fix this.
You know, it's interesting. My grandmother lived to be 99. And so the last 5 or 6 years, she lived in New York City. She moved in with my parents. She was there for 3 or 4 years. And then they simply couldn't do the day-to-day take care of her. So she was in a nursing home that was like 2 miles from their house. My mom used to go down there every day, spend part of the day with her. My dad would go there every day after work on his way home from work.
What a good son.
My dad, I was talking to him, I don't know, a couple of weeks ago. He said, yeah, you know, they had the flu there once. They wouldn't let me in. They brought the staff, all ended up getting overtime that week because they kept the people in their rooms. They shut down the common area. You know, they sanitized the whole place. They brought people their meals. And then they also had people that were the people on overtime and stuff would be there and just to be in the rooms and to talk to people, so that they weren't totally isolated. I don't know when that was, 10, 12, 14 years ago. Some dumpy little nursing home in upstate New York knew how to do some of this stuff. And just because it was a flu. And everyone knows, elderly are more vulnerable to the flu. And again, if we would have taken 10% of the effort and focused it on the main problem there, I think those numbers would be dramatically different.
Right. Now, as you said, in Kansas, right, if you take, you know, three of those homes out, the numbers go straight to the floor.
Yeah.
And so, yeah. I again, you know, hardest to do in a democracy is to have mature conversations, especially when you have a media that is more focused on, you know, headlines and their own narrative than they are the truth. And so to me, what it promotes is stupid stuff like you're seeing in California and in other states. For instance, the subway just came up as a subject that had to be stopped and cleaned, right, a week ago.
Yeah. So they shut down part of the subway service in New York and probably contributed to the spread of the virus because by running fewer trains, the other trains are more crowded.
And that is the incubator, right? Those common services, that crowding. But to me, that's really – what defines the major difference? You know, there's a lot of cities around the country that have population density. Chicago, Miami, Los Angeles, you know, San Francisco's got pretty high density. You know, what makes New York so different? It's the subway.
Yeah, New York and then maybe Chicago.
Maybe. A distant maybe.
And Boston is a much lower subcategory.
Right.
But everywhere else...
Right.
We're in their freaking cars.
Right. So you just figured out now that we've got to do something to mitigate this in this perfect petri dish that we jam everybody every day. I mean, are you shitting me?
And I got to tell you something. When I used to take the metro in D.C., not a lot, but, you know, once a week, once every couple of weeks, I never put my hands on those bars or those straps.
Oh, you didn't?
If I had to stand up, I wrap my elbow around it. It's like being on a ship.
I'm all right? My hands are all over that stuff. Oh, yeah.
You're going up and down those ladders on the ship, and you got to hold the handrail. But how many times did you wash your hands?
Never.
Ugh, I did all the time.
You're a weirdo. See? There you go. That's the whole narrative. Don't know why you joined, right? And it culminates full circle with you wash your on ship and you wash your hands all the time. Never did I wash my hands. Never did I wash my hands. On the USS Ranger, ship's company, guarded nuclear weapons 2 years. We're at sea most of that. Never washed my hands the whole time.
Where the toilet's overflowing on that 50-year-old ship all the time.
Yeah, whatever. Whatever. Right? I mean, look, I used to put my mouth on those bubblers at parks and suck the water out of it in Sacramento, where it was 103 every day in the summer, and thought nothing of it.
We were tougher back then in the 70s. That's what it was.
Tell me about it. Hey, I was talking, I was interviewing, I sent you that thing about the fighting around on the backside of Operation Buffalo. And I interviewed that guy yesterday, and I said his name is Ray Linebaugh, and he was in Alpha Company 1-9. And I said, hey, when you were a kid, if they would have said you got to stay at home and not leave the house, what would you have done? And he starts laughing. He said, hell, we weren't staying at home. Right.
Yeah.
And now, but kids now, if you read stuff about them, they don't have sex, they don't smoke, they follow directions. Kids now, I would no more have stayed home with my mother, right, for weeks, and my three sisters, I would never have done it. And I was a good kid.
You know, you think about it though, how many times in the last 15 years have you seen a pickup baseball game? Or football game?
No, they don't do it anymore.
They don't do it.
No, they don't know how.
All we did.
Right. They don't know how. Like, to get together and then make up the rules. Okay, you can catch the foul ball out of the tree. If you hit it that way, that's an out. Right? They, like, what do you mean? And then, like, when – or you didn't make the rule for the tree, but Vito hits a pop-up and it's going in the tree and I'm running to catch it and I yell, you can catch it out of the tree, right? Right, and then they yell bullshit. You can't, and then you have to like the whole game stops for 10 minutes as you negotiate a solution to it, and then you go. And same thing, you know, on your come home, change your clothes after school on your bike, and you're with your friends, and you're you know, and shit happened. You know, somebody might get into a fight with another group of kids or something like that, and you were expected to man up as a 9-year-old kid, and so life a little bit different than the parental supervision that's and I had my daughters on last Friday and I was talking to them about it. And I said, so they're like, well, what would you do? I'm like, you lie about it. What do you think you could do? Are you guys stupid? And they're like, you're not supposed to lie. I know you're not, but you can confess it. We're Catholic. Once you confess it, you're absolved. It's perfect. Okay. As long as you feel contrition.
That's a liberal interpretation.
But it works for me, right? And they're like, oh, my God, really? I'm like, yes, what are we going to do? Sure. We're going to do what our parents tell us our whole lives? Hello? And they're like, okay, we're done with you. All right, what haven't I been smart enough to ask you about the Navy, about the COVID-19 thing, or about your own experience with trauma that you want to get off your chest before we end this thing?
I'm tired of COVID. I got to tell you, really tired of it. I would reinforce with people about trauma. If you know someone that's going through, it means a lot. Just, you know, getting sympathy cards from people. It meant a lot to me. And I still follow my wife's Facebook page, and people still put stuff on there. And it means a lot to me that people still think and care. And you never know how valuable that can be to people that are going through tough times.
I don't even think we know until you're on the receiving end of that. And it is that whole song, "You Are the Wind Beneath My Wings." Because when you're devastated, and I, you know, in my life, I remember, you know, standing behind my sister after her sons were murdered. And I'm standing behind my sister in case she faints, so I can hopefully catch her before her head hits the ground. And just all the people at the funeral who we knew when we were little kids, right? I mean, we had neighbors who hated me because I'd jump over their fence to get baseballs that got hit in their backyard and shit. And they used to get pissed because sometimes I'd come down on their bushes or something like that. I don't know. But, I mean, for them to show up and hug you and tell you how much they care about you and love you, I mean, literally. I mean, and I don't know that you really – you don't really know how important that kind of help is until you really need it. And then and then you experience it in a way, you know, like, and I have a saying that you never, never really appreciate help until you really need it. And then that hand that reaches out, it's a life raft, you know, through a very, very turbulent time. So,
yeah, without a doubt. And you know what? The person may not be able to express to you their appreciation. I know I didn't do it to everyone, but it does matter. And the other thing I'll tell you, you know, you don't get over it. You get through it. You don't get over it
ever.
And don't think that there's going to be some switch that all of a sudden everything's great. It's going to be better. And part of many things are going to be great, but you know,
I think, and this is just my experience from doing this and my life experience is that I don't know. And I was talking about this in the first hour. I don't know why the VA and the people that treat this are so fucked up that they don't look at us and tell us the truth, because that's what I do. I mean, I start post-traumatic winning with, "I'm here to tell you the truth today. And if you don't like it, I don't give a fuck." Right. Which Marines like, what did he just say? That's right. And so it starts with, you're never going to get over this shit, okay? Ever. You watch the guys in World War II, right, on History Channel. They can describe it in slow motion, high definition. It is seared into your brain. You're never, ever, ever going to get over it. And you begin to tell them these truths. You have to get your money in order. You got to. If you suffer with severe trauma, you can't drink or do drugs because that shit unleashes the beast.
Yeah.
You've got to
stay
physical fitness because it promotes mental fitness. So you got to live with self-discipline. You got to understand. You got to learn to coexist. And every opportunity you get, touch the lives of other people with these lessons you've learned. And if you do that, right, you'll give your suffering meaning, as Viktor Frankl talks about. But I mean, nobody ever told any of us this shit, Will. And that's what I'm pissed about these days. Is that why are guys like me and guys like you going around and telling people, this is what I've learned, this is what I want you to know, and if you ever go through this thing, this stuff is the truth. And now I'm irritated about it. Because you tell people the truth and then you challenge them and And what do? They rise to the occasion, and they do those things. And then you get this email that says, "I cannot believe, you know, how much my life has changed since sitting through your class or since talking to you, right?" And it helped so much that somebody just looked at me. And I remember, you know, one of the first kids I ever dealt with looked at me and said, you know, "Does it ever stop hurting?" And I said, "No, never." And he said, "That's what I knew I could trust you, because you didn't sugarcoat shit to me. You just told me the truth." And now that kid told me in August that he thinks he's kept 9 people from committing suicide by simply regurgitating. And we have that in our power to do. But I don't understand why. You know, I had another Marine who didn't have any trauma in his life. He's a MARSOC guy now, so I don't use his name, but... he said, "So I thought I didn't want to go to your class. I did everything I could to get out of it. And then I sat through it and I said, that's one of the best classes I've ever been in." 90 days later, his dad commits suicide. And he doesn't talk about his mom, so she's not a part of his life. So he loses his only parent. And when he saw me at Camp Lejeune, he said, I just want to thank you for that class because I knew what to do. So our experiences can save people that are in that blackness, who are groping for a solution and don't know where to go. And they can also, I mean, when I save, I mean offer a path to a better place. And they can also be preemptive in nature because somebody like that sergeant can say, I know what to do. I sat through that class, right? I knew it, and he's told me, I knew what to do for me, I knew what to do for my friends, and I knew what to do for my family to help. And I just want to thank you. And so to me, that's got me a little bit irritated.
Yeah, you know, and in my life, I have been on the road, you know, with sort of my story, and I won't. When I was working, most of the people there were much younger than me, and things would come up, and so I had a point of reference to just try and help people and mentor them in this kind of a way, and it actually does bring some meaning to the fact that my wife got sick on a Thursday and died the next Saturday. And so I don't necessarily broadcast, but I try and be a node in a network and take opportunities to try and help people out, because I'll tell you, it helps me out too.
And that's the thing. You know, that's, to me, that's the thing, is that, look, what's interesting, I've found, is that if when somebody's struggling, if you say, hey, man, you know, you really need to get your shit together, and you know, we love you and we care about you, and, you know, a lot of times that doesn't resonate, right?
Yeah.
But when you say, hey, you need to get your shit together, because here's what we need. We need you to help us help other people. For whatever reason, that resonates. Right? Maybe not doing it for me, but maybe understanding how I fit back into this team, how my experiences can help others, that is transformative. And as you just said, you know, helping others helps me. And I don't think you need to be a broadcaster, but you need to slay targets of opportunity.
Exactly.
Right? And they're all around you. People that have, you know, been victims of domestic violence, people that have had like you did, you know, had to kiss a loved one goodbye. You know, again, men aren't supposed to bury their wives. You know, your wife is supposed to bury you, right? Your children are supposed to bury both of you, right? And when the circle of life gets crooked or isn't a circle or takes some other geometric shape, you know, that shit's rough, right? And for whatever reason, and this might be because of the people that gravitate to the Marine Corps, or because that's the and veterans in general that service is a big part of our lives. I might not do it for myself, but I will, you know, I will embrace it for the greater good and being a good teammate and doing that. So I think that's kind of an interesting piece of all of this.
Yeah, absolutely.
All right. My guest for the last hour and a half, hour and 45 minutes, has been Will Cosentini. Covered a lot of ground. Will, I certainly appreciate it. I hope you don't mind coming back on occasion and talking about these things, because I always enjoy the conversation.
Yeah. And again, burn it into your brain, right? The key to happiness is freedom. The key to freedom is courage. Be courageous. Be free. So
there you have it.
I'll see you, Mac. I appreciate it.
All right, bud. See you. Will Cosentini here on a Tuesday edition of All Marine Radio, right here on your home for it. I'll read you an email here. Like an earlier listener, I did not expect that interview to turn in that direction. The people you have on are certainly interesting, Mac. You have a pretty interesting and unique group of friends. I will keep him in my prayers tonight. And there are lessons in all of this that we're going through for us. Very fundamental lessons about being frugal, about being humble, and knowing that the rainy day is out there. For a lot of people that are my age, and then in parentheses, in my 40s, we have never seen anything like this. And you're absolutely right about this is what our grandparents and our great-grandparents lived through. It's sad that we all have to relearn these lessons, but I think in the long run, we should all learn from them and make ourselves more solid as families in a lot of different ways, financial being one of them. Thanks for having your friend on. Will's a good guy and smart guy. And like all my friends, not afraid to tell the truth. So tomorrow you're going to meet, I've talked about him, Ray Linebaugh. Yeah. As we continue looking at and kind of moving the kaleidoscope around the events that are known as Operation Buffalo. So don't miss that. Now, if you just tuned in, you're going to hear in hour one me talking about post-traumatic winning a little bit and my frustration that I think the VA's approach is entirely wrong. And their approach is one of endurance. Shield yourself from liability. Give them these drugs. Send them to these therapies. That does not change people, though. That does not transform them. It does not teach them. Right? It helps them endure. And so, I'm not happy with that. So, on a Tuesday, the 5th day of May, happy Cinco de Mayo, by the way. You know, don't be afraid to reach out to people. And in particular, anybody that you know that's experienced the whole COVID thing in a hospital, emergency room, as a professional, nurse, doctor, first responder, don't be afraid to tell them, hey, man, I got a path that I want you to look at. It's a path that talks about how to deal with acute trauma. And, you know, and Will's a great example of it. And at the end of, and again, at the end of that discussion, what do you say? Helping other people helps me, right? So, there you have it. On a Tuesday, we are over and out. Have a great day. Don't be afraid to change somebody's life. Post-traumatic winning, man. It's the real fucking deal. It is written in the experience of Marines and veterans. And it is a path to a greater place. So go ahead and preach the gospel. So they can live the high life.